KCUR has been on the air for 60 years. And you can hear how much we've changed. Just listen.
The Kansas City Royals are the 1985 baseball champions. They won the World Series last night, beating the St. Louis Cardinals in a seventh-game shutout, 11-0.
There was some disappointment that we couldn't see colors, which often accompany full eclipses. The clouds were in the way. And some of the younger astronomers seemed a little tired, several hours beyond their bedtime.
It's lunchtime. I'm Emmanuel Cleaver, and this is Under the Clock.
I'm an employee of the Department of Agriculture, and the State Fair is a division of the Department of Agriculture. We promote it every year.
Go over and stand on about Westport and Broadway. The wind's got to be a little bit right, and then, comes the wonderful smell of the Manor Bakery. In fact, if you want to do that at 3 o'clock in the morning, I think they do cinnamon rolls then.
You could almost hear the collective gasp of disbelief across Kansas City when it became clear Buck O'Neill's name was missing from that list.
Did you hear some familiar voices in there? I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we're telling the story of this radio station, from our humble beginnings, which we'll hear about in a minute, to a station known today across the country as sort of a jewel in the public radio system. We'll start that story with Chuck Haddix, host of The Fish Fry. He arrived at KCUR in 1984. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Gina. Good to be here with you this morning.
Thanks for being here. How did you first get involved at the station?
Well, I was working in the record business, and I wanted to make a parallel career move, and I was interested in doing broadcasting. I'd listened to jazz on KCUR, and so I was interested in working my way into a slot. And Les Cook, who's an editor, I believe, for Morning Edition now, was a reporter then. And he kind of brought me in and showed me the ropes a little bit. And he kind of did it under the table. And then Sam Scott, who was the general manager, found out about it.
So a highly professional operation.
At that time, we were broadcasting out of a house on Holmes between 53rd and 54th. And the broadcast studio was in the front room of the house. And really, it was a house. I mean, nothing had been remodeled. And the production studios were in the basement. And
do I understand right? This is just, it had basically been built like the station by hand in this house by just like a couple of people.
Well, originally it was over by where the Kaufman Gardens, the house, the row of houses where the Kaufman Garden was originally. And Sam Scott and Billy Honeycutt, and Sam was the first general manager, and Billy Honeycutt was the engineer. They built the studio literally by hand. They used butcher glass for the glass between the studio and the control room, and the antenna was on Schofield Hall, and it's on a tower near Schofield Hall, which they actually dug and erected. I mean, he just willed it into being, basically. And in those days, not many people had FM radio, so Sam would and Billy would sell you an FM radio for $10. And deliver it to your house. And they literally built the audience one radio at a time.
Please listen. Here's your radio.
Exactly.
So you showed up at this house on Holmes with what, a stack of records?
Yeah, well, I applied for an announcer position and I didn't get it. And then I quit the record business because I wasn't making any money. I worked for Brandsmart for one day and I got a call from Ron Jones. And Ron said, "You want to go to work for us?" I said, "Oh, man, yes, of course. I would have done it for free." And so I started doing jazz three nights a week, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. We had a program called The Jazz Place, and it was on from 10 until 2 o'clock in the morning. And I would go in and engineer for the Walt Bodine program starting at 6 o'clock.
What did that entail at the time, engineering a live show?
Well, you know, basically the same thing. We'd run the boards, what I was doing. I'd go in and run the board for Walt Bodine, and he had a two-hour-long program. And they threw me in, and I didn't know how to announce, and no one showed me how to do it. So I learned how to announce by watching Walt Bodine. And Walt had a way of sitting down and going, "Come on in."
You know, that was his catchphrase when he started a show, right?
Yeah, yeah. He'd sit down and he'd welcome you to the show, and he just made people feel good, you know, and just in very, very conversational style. So I'm like the Walt Bodine of R&B, because I learned how to broadcast from Walt, so a lot of that stuck with me. And in those days, you know, the programming was considerably different. We had these little half-hour programs, like Antoineau, a French program one night. And then
which it's so
radio
strange
reader
to me that we had a French program on.
Oh, yeah. There was – I think there were some very exotic programs. We were much more like what today is a community radio station, where we had a lot of producers from the community that came in and did these half-hour-long programs.
On just whatever they were interested in?
Right. Just – it was they would have thematic. Like, for example, on Sunday nights we had a guy that did a comedy show, and he'd come in and play comedy records. It was very interesting. It made for some interesting radio, but the programs were like a half an hour long. And we had this one program called Radio Reader with Dick Estelle, where he would go in and read a book. And some of it was quite compelling. But he
read books on mic?
You know, we would receive these records of Dick Estelle reading.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Reading these books, and it was a nationally syndicated program. And boy, if you played the wrong track, man, you heard about it from the announcers, from the listeners. And then I worked on Sundays. I worked played opera programs backwards on Sundays often. So
you've mentioned a lot of names, and I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about some of the personalities involved. I mean, Sam Scott, for example.
Well, Sam Scott was he founded the station, and he was the general manager, and he came out of the communication studies department. And Sam was, shall we say, he's a pretty stern taskmaster. If you mispronounced something on the air, he'd let you know about it. He'd come in and actually dress you down when you were on the air about you mispronounced this. And rumor had it, in those days we would take network feeds, we would record them to open reel tape. And rumor had it that if you missed a feed, that you would get fired. Sam would fire you if you missed a feed. And so he was for somebody that was in the communication business, he really didn't have too much to say. So when he said something, you listened to him. And I credit him for my start. The reason they hired me is because I knew music, not because of my broadcasting skills. That came later.
Well, so what are some of the biggest ways that you have seen the station change in the time you've been here?
I think the biggest change is when Patty Cahill became the general manager, because she really modernized the station. And she endured some pretty strong headwinds, but she eliminated the half-hour programs and got into, hour-long programs, and also became more – see, Sam was a founder of NPR, so he was very reluctant to take on PRI programming, particularly – A Prairie Home Companion, when it was at its hottest, he would not carry it, because he saw PRI as challenging NPR's programming. So when Patty came aboard, she brought in PRI and extended out the programs and modernized the sound of the station.
Well, in just a few minutes, we will hear from her. We'll first hear from one of the former news directors about the days when they still cut tape for broadcasts by hand with razor blades. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're telling the story of KCUR as the station celebrates its 60th anniversary. I'm joined now by Mary Jo Draper. She came to KCUR in 1985, is that right?
I think it was 1986.
Well, Mary Jo, hello. You started out on a daily show that aired at 6 p.m., is that right?
That's right. There were three of us on the news staff, and we did a daily show. I think we were insane, but...
What do you mean? What was insane about it?
That's a lot of news to put together for a small staff like that. And sometimes I think we were brilliant, and sometimes I think we were not so brilliant. But boy, we put a lot of heart into it.
what kind of hours were you putting in to make a newsroom function on three people?
I remember being here almost every weekend. But I think we were having a good time. It was a fun time to be doing news, and we were getting to cover everything, because when you have such a small staff, you're not broken down into beats so much. So we were out and about in the community everywhere.
You covered City Hall, right?
I did cover City Hall, yeah.
What was that like in the 80s?
It was a lot of fun. And there was one of the things that was really fun about it, and one of the things that I think is kind of sad about the world today is that there were so many reporters there and it was so competitive. At the time, we had the Kansas City Star and the Kansas City Times. There were three or four radio stations. There were all the TV stations. So in addition to sort of the fun of covering City Hall and the political stuff that was going on, there was a healthy, fun competition. And I think that drove people, and I think it made for good journalism.
What were some of the big news moments while you were here?
Well, one of the ones that I always remember is the explosion down by Bannister Mall when the firefighters went to investigate and the fire truck blew up and there was a huge. I can remember I was at home and turned and I felt heard the sound of the explosion and then turned on KCUR and heard that there had been an explosion and immediately grabbed my tape recorder and went there. And I remember that everybody that worked here, all three of us, which at the time was Laura Ziegler and
me. Who is still here today, of course.
Who is still here today, and Kathy Lohr, who went on to be a correspondent for NPR. All three of us worked all day on that story, putting things together, obviously feeding stuff to the network because it was a national story, but, you know, putting together a local story as well. And I remember being exhausted at the end of that day, but sort of proud about the job we'd done.
Is there something about the way radio worked back then, the way that broadcast journalism functioned, that you think people have either forgotten or maybe never appreciated to begin with?
Well, one of the things that was really different back then was, you know, it was before the digital age. And so we put together stories with on tape. So we had a big old reel of tape. And if you wanted to make an edit into a story or put your voice next to somebody else's voice in a story, you had to take a single-edged razor blade and cut that tape and tape it back together. And to do a complicated mix in this studio right here where we are, back in the old days, we had some really, really old reel-to-reel machines. And I remember Ron Jones, who's still here, was the production manager back then, program director. And when he would mix our pieces, we would have to stand at one of the machines and spin it because it didn't get up to speed quite as fast as the other ones. So there were, you know, it was a lot more technically difficult back then to produce radio.
Would you say that your time here, I mean, that you were part of any kind of major transition for the station itself? Like, just when you think about when you arrived versus when you left, how would you describe that trajectory?
I would say that when I first came here and when I first discovered public radio, which I did when I was living in Detroit, and then I actually went to graduate school because I fell in love with public radio and wanted to work for public radio, we sort of saw ourselves as an alternative source of news. We sort of saw ourselves as you would get your main source of news from the Kansas City Star, but you would turn to KCUR for stories maybe you didn't hear then or a different point of view. I would say that over the years that I was here, we made the transition into thinking of ourselves and NPR thinking of itself as a major source of news. So we could be your entire source of news, not just sort of an alternative source. And that was, to me, that was sort of a growing up process. And there were good and bad things about it, I think, but in the end, I think it's made public radio really strong.
When you talk about, you know, radio at that time, sort of before that transition into a major news source, what was your favorite thing about it?
I think my favorite thing was, as I said, there weren't that many of us, and there wasn't a lot of structure sometimes. So you could, you know, we covered the stories that were really important that the community needed to know. But we could, I think we also could have a lot of fun and we could go do stories that were just a little bit wacky sometimes.
Mary Jo Draper, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you later about some of those wacky stories. But in a few minutes, we'll hear from Patty Cahill, who really put KCUR on the map in a lot of ways in her 25-year tenure as general manager. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're taking a walk through this station's history in honor of our 60th anniversary. Patty Cahill is here with me now. She's on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's Board of Directors, and she used to be the general manager here at KCUR. She came on as general manager in 1987.
That's correct.
Hi, Patty. You came from a station in Wichita where you'd worked in the trenches as a producer and a reporter, but you'd actually interned here at KCUR before that, right?
I was a reporter-producer at KCUR in 72 to 75.
So what are your memories from the station in that time period? What was it like here?
We were located in the old Pierce Street houses, if you know that, just a block near 47th Street. And there were, I think, six or seven of us full-time for the station. A lot of students that were on the air, and it was mostly classical music. I put together an hour-long newscast at noon, coming in at 5 in the morning. And it was, there were two of us in the news department, the news director who did nothing, and me who did everything. Well, at least I felt like it.
And so you came in at 5, did an hour-long newscast that aired at noon, and this was out of a house. There were like 5 or 6 of you. What did the other people do?
There was a music director who talked with the students who were on the air doing classical music, announcing it differently than other people might. The news director, the manager, his secretary, and an engineer.
Well, so, and then you came on later as the general manager. Mm-hmm. Describe the KCUR you encountered when you took that helm.
Back in the 70s and early 80s, public radio thought we should be everything to everyone. And to do that, it was hour-long, half an hour-long, different programs. So we had on French and Indian movie music, and Spanish for half an hour, and reggae, and it was very hard to listen to. I think at that time, public radio was more for the producers than for the listeners.
So when you came on, what was the vision you had for a new direction for the station, and how did you set about going that way?
I was looking for consistency, and it seemed as though our strength was in news and local news and information, and not in classical music, which was competing with another classical music station in town, as well as the public radio station in Kansas. So we tried to emphasize more local news and consistency. So when you turned into KCUR, you knew what to hear. You knew what you were going to hear.
So it wasn't going to be different based on just who was running that show?
That's correct. It wasn't for the producers, it was for the listeners.
That sounds like kind of maybe like a mission that you had, that you were making something that was more listener-oriented. But what did that look like to really take steps in that direction? I mean, what did you have to do to build a station that was for the listener more?
I had to eliminate a lot of programming. Chapter a day, a half an hour at 9:30 every night. You know, if people wanted to listen to a book, they could get it on cassette at that time. And had some arguments about that. And then there was, the French and Indian movie music. There was reggae. I wanted consistency. I wanted, ended up eliminating the classical music during the day.
When you eliminated all that stuff, you obviously had to put something else in place. Can you talk about what you built and how you did it?
Well, we extended Morning Edition. I think it went off the air at 8 or 9 in the morning. We moved some programming, moved Walt Bodine to the mornings rather than in the evening where there were less listeners.
And there are probably listeners now who don't know who Walt Bodine is. He was a broadcasting legend locally and had his own show here on KCUR.
Oh, he was very, very helpful to me during the time. He really did encourage me to make changes. I was picketed for a while. Don't be a meanie to Walt Bodini. I thought that was kind of cute. when we took Folk Waves off the air, there were picketers out there and all. But there was such a small audience. I had been to enough public radio meetings about programming that we pretty much decided that if you could send out cassettes instead or a newsletter to people, that was too small of a program for a mass medium. And so those were the changes I made with a lot of help.
What are some of your proudest achievements when you think about just the station and how it changed while you were in charge?
I think the programming, like we talked about, moving into an era where the listeners were the most important element and not the producers. I think that was what I'm proudest of, and it still holds today. True.
Do you have a sense of how listeners' expectations have changed in the time that since you started working in public radio to now?
Well, when I started working working at KCUR, we had one computer, okay? And if we wanted to send a fax, we'd have to go to the mailroom. So technology has changed considerably, and I think that with people's expectations. I mean, I listen to KCUR on my Google Home and on my smartphone now. And so I think technology has improved the opportunity for people to hear us wherever they are, whenever they are, podcasting. You know, I listen to podcasts all the time. In fact, I listen to them to go to sleep sometimes.
Now you serve on the CPB, and KCUR is obviously part of not just a larger public radio system, but also a whole broadcast journalism landscape. How do you think we fit in, like, now that you have this sort of broader perspective?
I'm really, really proud of all the things Nico has done and KCUR has done in the last 5 or 6 years since I've been gone. I'm very proud. It's expanded tremendously. It's gotten a lot of grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to expand the reach. One of the things we wanted to do was make the news departments and individual stations reach out and work with other stations. And I think Harvest is an excellent example of that.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, Patty Cahill, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard and Frank Morris. Good morning.
Hi, Gina.
We are talking about the history of KCUR, and you've been here for a lot of it. And I know you've been listening to what you've heard so far.
A bit, yeah.
Is there anything that, like, really you want to respond to, first of all?
Well, you know, I mean, I hadn't really anticipated that question. I don't know what I want to respond to. I mean, we can definitely add on a little bit. You know, Patty was talking about sort of the changing, you know, making it, you know, keeping it focused on the listener. That's something Patty was always saying. That and Weeby News. Every time something came up, that was Patty's refrain, Weeby News. And so Patty, right from the get-go, had a focus to make this place relevant, to keep it relevant. She knew long before most people in the system seemed to know, long before I ever considered anything like this, that public radio stations just regurgitating NPR weren't going to make it. And they're not really necessary, and they're less and less necessary as you know, you have to do your own content. So Patty has been that force for, you know, forever, you know, and then leading to Nico, which took off even farther. But
Nico Leone, the current manager.
Nico, right.
So, Frank, when you started, you were a part-time reporter?
Yeah, that's right. I got a call. I was working in a bakery, in a restaurant bakery, and I got a call. I didn't have a phone, a cell phone in my pocket. I went to go to the front desk, and the guy hands me a phone, and it's Mary Jo Draper, and she's offering me a part-time job. And so that was great. I already had another radio job in Lawrence. I was working at a commercial radio station doing news there. And so that was cool. I'd done a couple of years, a couple of legislative sessions interning at the Kansas State House. So there was a little bit of my stuff on the air here. So I had a little bit of an in. And plus, my boss at the Kansas State House was the beloved Tama Wagner. And she had a lot of clout. And she, you know, was good to me and helped me get the job here.
What would you say about the way news was covered then that people who either work in radio now or consume public radio now might have either forgotten or, not appreciate?
Well, you know, it's kind of like Mary Jo was saying. You know, it used to be there was a lot of competition, and the commercial radio guys kind of considered themselves the big boys, and they would kind of, you know, all but sort of pat you on the head if you worked in public radio. Not to mention all the TVs. I mean, you know, these are nice people, by and large. There's a bunch of them at every story. And public radio was always the little, you know, like, you go and try public radio, but you're never going to be us. There was that kind of feel. And now that's completely flipped over. And so that's a really a beautiful thing. And, you know, I just wanted to say, too, you know, there was a moment when I took over as Patty, you know, let me be news director after Mary Jo left. And I was down to just me and half of Laura Spencer's time. That was the whole news department at that point. And I had to put out a job, advertised a job, a radio reporting job. Nationwide, and got 6 applicants. 2 of them were qualified, and they were like polar opposites. Steve Bell was one guy, great voice, big presence, Mr. You know, smooth radio. And this other guy, Matt Hackworth, was just this like sparky young guy. I don't know, he was like 24, 25, worked at a bunch of small newspapers, didn't really have that great of it, but he had tremendous headroom. And I was hemming and hawing. I went to Patty's office. I'm like, I don't know, Patty. This guy, they're totally off. How can you not hire Steve Bell? But then there's Matt. She says, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to hire both of them. And she said, great, do that. And that from that moment on, we've done nothing but grow. You know, from that little point where Patty just said, yeah, let's hire them both, because they had different skill sets. And then there's just been little acceleration points beyond that. And so that to me was, in my mind, that was kind of like the big bang that set up this station, what it is now, which is a honest to God major player in this medium, breaking stories all the time with really great journalists covering everything across 2 states. A big, big difference.
You know what amazes me partly in this story is just the idea that job openings in public radio now, the idea that you would get a stack of only 6 applications, because now you have a whole generation of people who grew up on public radio, who have wanted to work in public radio their whole lives.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it was kind of a low ebb, and people weren't sure if public radio was going to survive or if it was going to thrive. And you didn't get paid much in public radio back in those days. So, I mean, it was a very, very different time. It was a great time to get in the door. But things have changed so dramatically.
Where do you see things headed now? I mean, what do you think with sort of the long view?
Well, you know, I love that we got Nico in here, Nico Leone, our current GM, replacing Patty. I mean, I feel like he's got the same mindset that Patty always had, which is that you have to produce, you have to contribute, you have to do something to make yourself relevant other than just piggybacking on NPR. So he and, you know, Donna Vestal, you know, we've become a player in the system through a lot of people's efforts. We're known across the public radio system as one of maybe a top 10 station. And that's important because a lot of these stations are going to go away, and because they're not necessary. It's not necessary to have a station regurgitating NPR.
Is that partly just the technological changes? People can get NPR
any way they want, a thousand different or, you know, dozens of ways. And so if you're going to be relevant, you have to be producing content. You have to be important to your community. And that's something that's being built here over the decades. And so I feel – plus we have a great funding model. And let's not forget that that sets us apart. You can't you know newspapers are dying, great newspapers, because they don't have a funding model like ours. So I'm pretty optimistic.
That's awesome. Frank Morris, thank you.
You bet.
This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Cheng, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. Central Standard will be back tomorrow. I'm Gina Kaufman. Thanks for listening.